It's 9 o'clock on a Thursday night, right here at Free Radio Santa Cruz. It's time for the Earth First Update. All the environmental news you can use. And let's start out with a panel discussion that is coming up this Saturday afternoon at 3 o'clock. It's called Defending the Wild, Eco-Action from Santa Cruz to Cascadia. Up and down the Pacific Coast, forests are falling, vibrant wild places are being silenced, and communities are rising up to stop the destruction. As the global struggle for ecological survival continues, join frontline forest defenders on October 12th, that's this Saturday, in Santa Cruz for an evening of storytelling, reflection, and discussion. There will be a panel discussion with guests from Santa Cruz Earth First, Cascadia Forest Defenders in Oregon, Little Lake Defenders in Willits, California, Earth First Humboldt on the North Coast, and Save Upper Campus from Santa Cruz. And once again, that's this Saturday, the 12th of October, from 3 to 5:30 p.m. at the Loudon Nelson Center, Room 3. Admission is free. And this event is co-hosted by Save Upper Campus and Central Coast Rising. Even though there's free admission, I would suggest that you maybe bring a donation. And if you'd like to actually get out and do something, volunteer for a fish count this Sunday. It's happening Sunday, October 13th, from 8:30 in the morning until 1:30 in the afternoon. Volunteers and professionals will join together to seine for fish in the Soquel Lagoon in Capitola Village. This is a great opportunity to learn about Soquel Creek and add the important data on the health of the watershed. Unless you fish, you may not have had the chance to see these beautiful fish up close. It's a pretty cool experience. If you'd like to volunteer, you just have to show up. Meet at the east side of the Stockton Bridge in downtown Capitola at 8:30 in the morning on Sunday, October 13th. If you have any questions about this event, contact biologist, that is fish biologist, Don Alley. And his email address is alleybio, A-L-E-Y-B-I-O, at cruiseio.com. And that's show up Stockton Bridge, Soquel, are in Capitola, 8:30 Sunday morning. Here's the Buffalo Field Campaign's update from the field. A buffalo ceremony has been held in Yellowstone National Park despite the government shutdown. National parks across the U.S. have been closed to the public since October 1st when the federal government shut down amidst a political deadlock in Washington, D.C. Despite the closures, Buffalo opened the gates to Yellowstone National Park this past Monday afternoon. Led by Blackfeet tribal member and spiritual leader of the Blackfeet Confederacy, James St. Goddard, members of the Buffalo Field Campaign and some visitors from afar entered the west entrance of the Yellowstone National Park to gather and pray for the well-being and recovery of America's last wild buffalo. St. Goddard approached park rangers to request access to Yellowstone National Park in order to exercise his First Amendment rights through a traditional prayer for the buffalo. According to National Park Service management policies, the American Indian Religious Freedom Act reaffirms the First Amendment's rights of Native Americans to access the National Park system lands for the exercise of their traditional religious practices. Park rangers responded that St. Goddard's buffalo prayer request would have to be run up the chain of command. St. Goddard said the ceremony must be held before the coming winter for the central interior buffalo herds that have not recovered since Yellowstone National Park in the state of Montana slaughtered over half the herd during the winter of 2007 and 2008. The central interior herds have also been heavily impacted by intensive hunting from the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes, Nez Perce, and to a lesser extent the Confederated tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation and Montana hunters. This summer, the park estimated 1,400 buffalo in the central interior, a disturbing and dramatic decline from the 3,500 buffalo that inhabited the region in 2005. Some scientists consider the central interior buffalo genetically distinct from the northern range buffalo. While we waited at the entrance, more park rangers arrived, as did a group of elder ladies from Ohio and a teacher and his students from Utah. The latter approached St. Goddard and his entourage to find out what was happening. Word finally came down from the park's, quote, chain of command that non-tribal members be excluded from entering the park to participate in the ceremony. That command was rejected, and the negotiation finally concluded with approval from park rangers to open the gate. When a park ranger escort, the determined company made their way to Fountain Flats to hold their prayer in the presence of trumpeter swans, curious ravens, Yellowstone's geysers, and buffalo bulls grazing along the Firehole River. While the most powerful government in the world remains shut down and the gates to America's national parks are closed, the spirit of protecting the buffalo prevailed over all these obstacles. You can contact the Buffalo Field Campaign at their website, www.buffalofieldcampaign.org, to find out everything they need and what you can do to contribute to it. You can send all that to the Buffalo Field Campaign, P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana, the zip code 59758. If you have any questions, give them a call. Their area code is 406, the number 646-0070. The webpage again, www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. And they are out on their road trips for another week or so, so they might not get to the phone right away. But do remember that the Buffalo Field Campaign is the only group working in the field every day in defense of the last wild buffalo in the United States. And from the Animal Liberation Front press office, we read that the 10th fur farm liberation of this summer has taken place. 250 or more mink were liberated in Grand Meadow, Minnesota. In a communique received by the North American Animal Liberation Press Office this week, a lone activist took credit for the 10th U.S. fur farm release in 2 months. In the latest action, at least 250 mink were freed from the Mirror Mink Farm in Grand Meadow, Minnesota. The communique reads in full, on October 7th, an individual working alone emptied the mink shed at the Mirror Mink Farm on Highway 16 in Grand Meadow, Minnesota. At least 250 fur-bearing mink ran to the lake directly behind the property. These animals needed very little help to gain their freedom. As the cages were being unlatched, many of the individuals pawed it open by themselves to make a dash. They were not domesticated and their spirits are not broken. Many of these minks screeched loudly at the sight of human hands, having only known the murderous hands of Einar Mir. The only thing keeping these animals imprisoned is our own fear and a simple latch on our cage. A wild existence for them was only feet away. Make animal liberation a reality. This is the 9th U.S. fur farm raid of the year. This level of activity has not been seen for nearly 20 years. To the fur farmers of the world, we have nothing to say to you. We offer only this prayer. The rest is secrets. Silence now. If night has fallen, sleep well. And that's the end of the communique. Imprisoned in cages for life or mercilessly trapped with painful leg hold traps in the wild, fur-bearing animals killed to make unnecessary fashion statements are forced to endure intensive confinement compared to the miles of territory these still wild animals would enjoy in their natural state. The natural instincts of these captive animals are completely frustrated. Self-mutilation, sickness, infection, poor sanitation, and the sheer stress of confinement lead many animals in captivity to a premature death. When they do survive, animals of sufficient size are killed by anal electrocution or gassing, and then they are skinned. In addition to liberating the wild animals destined for a certain painful and agonizing death, another goal of liberationists is to cause economic damage to fur retailers and farms. Dozens of stores and fur farming operations have seen economic ruin since Operation Biteback began by the Animal Liberation Front in the 1990s. The Animal Liberation Front utilizes economic sabotage in addition to direct liberation of animals from conditions of abuse and imprisonment to halt needless animal suffering. By making it more expensive to trade in the lives of innocent sentient beings, the Animal Liberation Front maintain the atrocities against our brothers and sisters are likely to occur in smaller numbers. The goal is to abolish the exploitation, imprisonment, torture, and killing of innocent non-human animals. A copy of The Final Nail, a listing of all known fur farm locations in North America, is available on the press office website homepage at www.animalliberationpressoffice.org. And Greenpeace has, the head of Greenpeace has offered himself as security to win bail for the piracy activists. In this story reported by Thomas Eskrit with editing by Philip Barbara of World Environment News, Thomson Reuters. The head of Greenpeace offered on Wednesday to move to Russia and stand as security for the release on bail of 30 people who were detained and charged with piracy by Russian authorities after protesting against oil drilling in the Arctic. The offer was made in a letter written by Kumu Daidu to Russian President Vladimir Putin that was seen by Reuters and sent on Wednesday. It follows a Russian court's decision to refuse bail to three of the detainees. Quote, I would offer myself as a guarantor for the good conduct of the Greenpeace activists were they to be released on bail, he wrote in the letter in which he offered to, quote, move his life to Russia for the duration of this affair, unquote. He added that neither he nor the activists saw themselves as being above the law and requested an urgent meeting with Putin. The detainees, 28 Greenpeace activists and two freelance journalists, have been held in northern Russian port city of Murmansk since authorities arrested them last month as their ship approached an oil platform owned by Gazprom, the big Russian oil energy company. Naidu, who was repeatedly arrested and later driven underground for his role in the struggle against apartheid in his native South Africa in the 1970s and 80s, said he was prepared to, quote, share the fate, unquote, of the Greenpeace activists. They face prison terms of up to 15 years if convicted. Quote, I do not expect to share their fate, but it is a risk I am willing to take, he said, adding that the, quote, actions of peaceful protesters could not be called piracy. Quoting more, you know that being accused of piracy, they are charged with a crime that did not happen, he told Putin in the letter. The Netherlands launched legal proceedings against Russia last Friday, saying that Russians had unlawfully detained the activists and others on the Dutch-registered icebreaker Arctic Sunrise when in international waters. After the protest, Russian Coast Guard officers forcibly boarded and seized control of the ship and towed it to Murmansk. Russia has denied Greenpeace's assertion that the ship had been in international waters when it was seized. And in news from the last day or two, the Russians are apparently using the contents of the ship's medical office, where there were some narcotics to be used for emergencies, and they are charging the Greenpeace activists also with possession of narcotics. So who knows where this is all going to wind up. And now we turn to a story by Richard Schiffman of The Atlantic entitled, The Southwest Forests May Never Recover from Megafires. If you doubt that climate change is transforming the American landscape, go to Santa Fe, New Mexico. Sweltering temperatures there have broken records this past summer, and a seemingly permanent orange haze of smoke hangs in the air from multiple wildfires. Take a ride into the mountains and you'll see one blackened ridge after another where burns in the past few years have ravaged the national forests. Again, this year, fires in New Mexico and the neighboring states of Colorado and Arizona are destroying wilderness areas. Fire danger is expected to remain abnormally high throughout the summer and throughout much of the Intermountain West. But abnormal fire risks have become the new normal. The tragic death of 19 firefighters in the Yarnell Fire near Prescott, Arizona, shows just how dangerous these highly unpredictable wind-driven wildfires can be. The past 10 years have seen more than 60 megafires over 100,000 acres in size in the West. When they get that big, firefighters often let them burn themselves out over a period of weeks or even months. These fires typically leave a scorched earth behind that researchers are beginning to fear may never come back as forest again. Fires, of course, are a natural part of the forest life cycle, clearing out old stands and making way for vigorous new growth out of the carbon-rich ashes. What is not natural is the frequency and destructiveness of the wildfires in the past decade. Fires which move faster, burn hotter, and are proving harder to manage than ever before. These wildfires are not exactly natural because science believes that some of the causes, at least, are human-created. For one thing, the intensity of the recent fires, researchers say, is in part a result of the warming and drying trend, which has been underway for over a decade, and which some climate scientists believe will become a permanent condition as anthropogenic climate change continues to increase. Experts also blame the fire suppression policies, which have been in effect for much of the last century. In the past, frequent low-intensity lightning fires left behind a park-like patchwork of woodlands and open meadows. The smoky bear philosophy of fire prevention interfered with this natural pattern. By always putting fires out rather than letting them burn freely, forests throughout the West have become thick and overgrown. This well-meaning but unwise policy decreased fire dangers in the short term, but increased them exponentially in the long run on 277 million acres of fire-prone public lands. When forests do burn now, instead of the gentler, meandering fires of the past, the unnaturally high fuel loads often make for rampaging firestorms that typically destroy everything in their path. In the earlier low-grade wildfires, the trees that survived seeded recovery in the next generation. Nowadays, by contrast, the fierce heat of the megafires frequently incinerates all of the conifer seeds and seedlings and sterilizes the soil, making it all but impossible for the forest to regenerate. In the Jemez Mountains west of Santa Fe, New Mexico, the charred remains of the 2011 Las Conchas blaze stretch for miles above the atomic city of Los Alamos. It was the biggest wildfire in New Mexico's recorded history until the following year, when lightning ignited the Whitewater Baldy Fire in the southern part of the state, torching an area nearly half the size of Rhode Island. Much of the Los Alamos burn resembles today a lunar landscape, vast slopes of denuded gray soil where little vegetation has come back. Hillsides once covered with ponderosa pine and squat drought-tolerant pinon and juniper trees now grow only in clumps of cheatgrass and invasive species, and occasionally bush-like shrub oaks. Biologist Craig Allen of the U.S. Geological Survey, who has spent years studying the Southwest forest ecosystem, says that areas like these won't be forested again in our lifetime, and possibly they never will be. The reason Allen and others are pessimistic is that climate change is hitting the Southwest harder and faster than most other areas in the United States. The region has warmed on average between 2 and 5 degrees during the past century, and this trend is expected to accelerate in the years ahead. Add to this the danger from what scientists call the possible megadrought. The Southwest has always been prone to extended dry periods like the one which archaeologists believe drove the Anasazi people of Chaco Canyon in the Four Corners area to the wetter Rio Grande Valley in the late 13th century. But a study published last year in the Journal of Nature Climate says that by 2050, the region will be even drier than in previous megadroughts. Moreover, hot summer temperatures in the Southwest will literally suck the water out of leaves and needles, killing trees in unprecedented numbers. The majority of forests in the Southwest probably cannot survive in the temperatures that are projected, said one of the study's co-authors, Park Williams, a bioclimatologist at Los Alamos National Laboratory in Environment 360. The stress that trees are already under becomes clear during a short drive south of Santa Fe. Whole hillsides near the town of Ubiquí, made famous by the haunting desert landscapes of Georgia O'Keeffe, are now covered by the ashen skeletons of pinon pine. The trees, weakened by years of drought, were finally killed off in the late 1990s by bark beetles, insects which have also devastated numerous stands of ponderosa and spruce at higher elevations. Given these plagues of biblical proportions, fire, heat, drought, and insects, the future for the Southwest forests looks dim. Whether they will survive at all may depend on what we do or fail to do in the next few years on the biggest plague of them all. Climate change. And moving to Yosemite National Park, Yosemite's largest ice mass is melting fast, in this story by Louis Sahagun of the LA Times. Climate change is taking a visible toll on Yosemite National Park, where the largest ice mass in the park is in a death spiral, geologists say. During an annual trek to the glacier deep in Yosemite's backcountry last month, Greg Stock, the park's first full-time geologist, found that Lyell Glacier had shrunk visibly since his visit last year, continuing a trend that may be more than a century old. Lyell Glacier has dropped 62% of its mass and lost 120 vertical feet of ice over the last 100 years. We give it about 20 years or so of existence, then it will vanish, leaving behind a rocky debris, Stock says. The Sierra Nevada mountains have roughly 100 remaining glaciers. Two of them are in Yosemite. The shrinkage of glaciers across the Sierra is also occurring around the world. Great ice sheets are dwindling, prompting concerns about what happens next to surrounding ecological systems after perennial rivulets of melted ice disappear. We've looked at glaciers in California, Colorado, Wyoming, Washington, and elsewhere, and they're all thinning because of warming temperatures and less precipitation, said Andrew Fountain, professor of geology and geography at Portland State University in Oregon. This is the beginning of the end of these things. If carbon dioxide levels continue to rise, the Earth will eventually become ice-free, according to a study by Ken McLeod, a professor of geological sciences at the University of Missouri, published in the October issue of the journal Geology. Research by scientists at NASA, the U.S. Geological Survey, and UC Davis suggests that absorption of sunlight by industrial air pollution, including soot or black carbon, is also causing snow and ice to melt faster. Yosemite's other glacier, the McClure, is also shrinking, but it remains alive and continues to creep at a rate of about an inch a day. Lyell, however, hasn't budged. It is the second largest glacier in the Sierra Nevada and the headwaters of the Tuolumne River watershed, but it no longer fits the definition of a glacier because it has ceased moving. The Lyell Glacier is stagnant, a clear sign it's dying, Stock said. Our research indicates it stopped moving about a decade ago. And that makes it an ice sheet rather than a glacier. Of particular concern is the effect on Yosemite's Tuolumne Meadows. After 2 years of drought, many of the streams that nourish the picturesque meadowlands have gone dry. The one exception, however, is the Lyell Fork of the Tuolumne River, which is sustained by runoff from Lyell and McClure glaciers. When the glaciers are gone, there will be no steady supplies of water in that drainage, Stock says. We don't know what the impacts of that will be on plants and animals that evolved with these ice flows. Future research projects will attempt to use climate shifts chronicled in the widths of tree rings in nearby forests to create computer models that will show the shrinkage of Yosemite's glaciers over the last 300 years and help predict when they will disappear entirely. Scientists also want to know why Lyell has stopped moving when neighboring McClure, which is half its size it was a century ago, continues to advance at the same rate it did when naturalist John Muir and his friend Galen Clark hammered wooden stakes into its icy crust in 1872 to prove that glaciers are living because they move and alter the landscape as they do so. Glaciers tend to flow like honey down a plate or slide over meltwater beneath them, Stock said. We suspect Lyell just isn't thick enough anymore to drive a downhill motion. Overall, the rate of glacier retreat has accelerated since 2000, Stock says. Eventually, there'll be nothing left. That's happened already at least once in Yosemite, geologists say. The Black Mountain Glacier, which Muir discovered, surveyed, and declared living in 1871, was gone by the mid-1980s. And let's turn to some biological diversity news. A suit has been filed to stop the first drilling site inside the Alaskan Reserve. The Center for Biological Diversity has sued the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, challenging its approval of an oil industry proposal to build the first drilling site inside the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. The approved plan would allow ConocoPhillips to bring roads and industrialization into the largest, most biologically rich river delta in the U.S. Arctic, as well as the country's largest roadless area, which sustained hundreds of thousands of water birds, including spectacled eiders and yellow-billed loons, along with caribou and other vulnerable animals. We are deeply concerned that this project would kick the door open to industrial development in the reserve's priceless habitat, said Dieter McDonnell, a senior attorney for the center. The oil industry promises to use cutting-edge technology in the Arctic to reduce impacts to sensitive habitat, but when push comes to shove, it opts for the cheapest methods and forgets about the wildlife. A planned pipeline over one of Colville River's largest channels also increases the risk of a catastrophic oil spill that would be devastating to birds and could dump oil into the Beaufort Sea, home of the endangered species like polar bears and ice seals. And here's some news of the wild and weird. Tree lobsters have escaped extinction by hiding under a single bush. In 1918, a British cargo vessel ran aground on Lord Howe Island, 300 miles east of Australia. When the ship was evacuated, a swarm of hungry black rats also hopped off and acquired a taste for the local haute cuisine. Enormous, flightless, nocturnal stick bugs with lobster-like exoskeletons. 2 years later, the rats were thriving, but the tree lobsters, as island settlers called them, had vanished. By 1960, scientists believed the tree lobsters were extinct. Fast forward to 2001, when two scientists climbing the tiny islet called Ball's Pyramid, with towering nearly vertical rock walls about 13 miles from Lord Howe Island, found a bush sheltering fresh insect poop. Since they couldn't find the poopers that day, researchers determined to make the formidable climb back to the bush at night and discovered 24 tree lobsters living around it. This single, precariously placed bush is presumably the last place on Earth where the critters exist in the wild. Now, after captive breeding success, conservationists are asking Lord Howe Island residents, won't you help these incredible insects repopulate your island? And that's it for the Earth First update for this week. The Earth First update is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. It's a production of Earth First Radio, and we're glad to bring it to you every week. If you'd like to hear the Earth First update again, you can do so by going to radio4all.net. That's radio, the number, 4all.net. When you get there, click on Earth First Update, and you will find all the Earth First updates there for you to download and listen to. Hopefully, we will be back on Radio Free Moscow in Moscow, Idaho, very soon. KRFP is at 92.5 FM, and the show used to be broadcast on Monday nights at 9:30. The Earth First Update will also be rebroadcast here on Free Radio Santa Cruz on Fridays, I believe at 3 o'clock. We'll have to see about getting the schedule updated to make sure that that happens. We want to thank you for listening to the Earth First Update, and do tune in again next week for another Earth First Update. And if you're listening to this, Earth First Radio needs a transmitter site. Send us an email to frsc@freakradio.org and let us know if you have a spot for our transmitter. Thank you for listening.